12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
Now, in those days, the Yankee trading ships were like big floating department stores. They traveled from city to city, and all the people went down there to buy all the things that they had been wanting all year, clothing and furniture and food and wines and cigars and so forth. They were very, really essential to the economy of California because the Californians had to have some market for their hides and tallow, which were really all that they had to sell at that time. So the trading ships took back loads of hides and tallow to New England and brought back all the things the Californians wanted.
And the captain of one such trading ship was Henry Delano Fitch. He was the first American to settle in San Diego and become a Mexican citizen at a time when this region was a part of Mexico. His life is the subject of this third program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me is San Diego historian and chief consultant for these programs, Dr. Claire Crane. Claire, I think that Henry Fitch is probably one of the least known or least familiar of the names of the people we'll be dealing with in our series. And I'd like to ask you, what are some of the things he's important for, and why is he indeed one of the least known names? Why don't we have a Fitch Plaza or a Fitch Hospital?
Well, I suppose that he's less well known because he didn't leave that kind of permanent mark in San Diego that's visible and something with his name on it, but he left something in a way which is much more important in the long run, and that is that he drew the first map of San Diego, and he set the original boundaries of the Pueblo lands of San Diego, and he drew the map in such a way that it included 11 leagues, which is somewhere between 40 and 50,000 acres. This was not customary for Spanish and Mexican pueblos. The customary size was only 4 leagues, and so Henry's map, giving us these generous boundaries, I think is the major contribution that he made. He's also important as a representative of the Americans who came into San Diego and settled here. He is the first permanent American to settle in San Diego and become a Mexican citizen, become a Roman Catholic, and of course one of the other things about Henry Fitch that's particularly interesting is the exciting courtship of Josefa Carrillo and their exciting elopement, which we'll hear more about later.
Now, Claire, there are several important events going on during the life of Henry Fitch that we've seen briefly in Old Town, and I'd like to recap now. What are some of the important historical dates, the important historical events that are ongoing during this period?
Well, we really have a very short period of time that San Diego is Mexican. It's only from 1821 to 1846. 1821 marks the date of the independence of Mexico from Spain, and 1846, of course, the end of the period, is the American conquest of California, making it part of the United States. During that 25-year period in between, I think probably the most important things that happened for San Diego were the secularization of the missions. This took place in 1833, and it meant that land that had belonged to the missions then was available for distribution to the Mexican citizens, to the friends and supporters of the Mexican governor of California.
Now, when the missions were secularized, the land was distributed, and that process is explained by Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego.
Well, these lands were granted to private individuals. There was a certain amount of graft and corruption, as you might imagine, with administrators controlling this land, but former soldiers, citizens could petition the governor for these private lands. In San Diego, we end up with Rancho Los Peñasquitos, Rancho Jamul, Rancho El Cajon, San Bernardo, Encinitas, all of the place names, really, these ranchos sort of were derived out of ex-mission lands around the ex-mission San Luis Rey, ex-mission San Diego. And during the Mexican period in California, some 700, 800 ranchos were granted, whereas in the Spanish period, only 20 were granted, because most of the land was occupied by the missions and their surrounding territories. In fact, at its height, the mission system encompassed land, for example, contiguous San Gabriel mission lands ran all the way on some maps to San Fernando mission lands, and then southward to San Juan Capistrano mission lands. And so the Padres felt that their mission lands ran all the way up the coast of California. And then you can also see why the civilians felt the Padres were in control of just too much land, and this, after all, should not all be set aside for the mission system, that the civilians deserved their areas. And this is, say, what leads into the rancho system of the Mexican period.
So most of the ranchos, then, the cattle ranches of the Mexican era, really developed out of former mission lands. And the names associated with these ranchos are very familiar to many of us. For example, El Cajon, Rancho Bernardo. These are former mission lands that have become town sites or subdivision areas or the names of communities within cities. One of the largest rancho grants, of course, was the Rancho Santa Margarita y Los Flores, 130,000 acres, which Governor Pio Pico generously gave to himself and his brother Andres Pico, and that, of course, is the area that became Camp Pendleton later on.
Yes, you can see that Governor Pico, being in a position of power, did select a very nice area for himself and his brother. The lands extended all the way from what we sort of think of as the boundary of Orange County or at San Onofre to the Santa Margarita River at Oceanside. It was about 133,000 acres. It extends all the way inland almost to Fallbrook. It was one of the, say, the most fertile agricultural areas. And then, as most of us here in San Diego know, the rancho was finally purchased by the United States government for the Marine Base Camp Pendleton. And it's probably fortunate in a way that this area has been maintained as the Marine Base, because it's still open space, very sparsely populated, and some people here say is a buffer for San Diego against the encroaching Orange County, Los Angeles area. And I think, I don't know what the plans are, I assume it will remain in the hands of the United States government for quite a while.
Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego.
The lands, of course, were held by the missionaries supposedly in trust for the Indians. The initial concept had been that the missionaries had control over the lands, so that when the Indians had been trained to become agricultural workers and craftsmen and to learn the Spanish language and customs, that then they were to become Spanish citizens. The land was to be turned over to the Indians. But, of course, as we know, that did not happen.
Dr. Lucy Killay, Executive Vice President of Fronteras de las Californias, has made a study of the effects of secularization of mission lands. There were many changes that resulted, primarily, as you mentioned, Claire, on the lives of the Indians who had been living on the missions up to that time.
They had been, for several generations now, been living in a compound kind of existence, dependent upon the communal type growing of food, having food issued to them, having clothing issued to them, having a bell ringing, requiring their attendance at church at a certain time every day. They had been leading this kind of existence, and suddenly they were told that this was no longer the case, that they were now free to leave. And some of them did return to their to the back country. Many of them, their own villages were long since destroyed or disappeared. But some of them did return back into the back country, into the hills, and join join villagers there, but and taking with them, I think, much more of the Spanish civilization and ways of doing things than the people in the back country had had. So it was a case, really, of the Indians from the missions taking some of what they had learned from the Spanish back into their own native culture. The effect on the land was very briefly a dividing up of the mission lands among the ranchers and the exploitation of that land with primarily by cattle grazing, the periods of drought, of floods that this area is subject to, took its toll. The native grasses were almost completely decimated. Many of the grasses that the Indians knew no longer exist. The landscape was changed by importation of weeds from European weeds or from other parts of, and from Mexico, changing the considerably the growth of the land, so of the growth on the land in the San Diego area, so that today a very large percentage of the plants that we think of as native are not. They're actually imported. The cattle moved in and changed, almost stripped the grassland areas near the coast in the valleys, and then the scrub brush and the weeds were able to move in where grass had once been. It changed the landscape.
Probably this had a good deal to do with the necessity then for having large land grants and for big grazing areas, because many of these grants were 5, 10, even 20, and 30, and 40,000 acres. And would this have been part of the reason for it then?
Yes, that was part of it. The other part of it was, of course, there weren't that many Spaniards, so that there was there was a vacuum, and they simply moved into it. Because, of course, the Indians' presence on the land was simply considered an advantage. It was not considered a conflict of ownership at all. So as the missions, their role was reduced simply to the spiritual functions, the ranchers then were able to move in completely, and there were no really limitations, although there were supposedly legal ones on the size of land grants, but this really didn't carry over into California. So the size of the ranches were not directly related to the needs of the ranchers, but of course there was some, if you had more cattle, then you could claim you needed more grazing space. And of course, as the land became less and less productive for grazing, you needed more and more land, but that did not always justify the enormous size of the ranches.
Dr. Lucy Killay, Executive Vice President of Fronteras de las Californias. To understand the contributions of Henry Fitch, it's necessary to know more about San Diego at this time. The Spanish settlement here began in 1769. In 1821, Mexico became independent, and San Diego continued to be a part of Mexico for about 25 years until the American conquest. And so, with its extensive Spanish heritage, the city of San Diego owes a great deal to Spanish law and attitudes toward the organization of a town. The basic body of Spanish law is known as the Laws of the Indies, explained here by Dr. Iris Engstrand of the University of San Diego.
The Laws of the Indies, as it became known, was actually not codified until 1680, but these were the laws that were passed regularly by the Council of the Indies. In 1573, there were a number of ordinances passed for the founding of towns, and this, of course, was very important for the Spanish to, say, transplant their civilization, and the laws were very detailed. They included the selection of sites. You had to select a site by a river, naturally to have a source of water, not too close to the sea. They always felt that sea air was not healthy, and the only reason you would locate by the sea was just for a port city, and preferably inland would be better. But they even were so careful that they felt that the sun should rise in the east, shine on the river before the town. And this would, I've never quite figured out what the purpose for this was. The normal size of a town was set at 4 square leagues, which is about 17,500 acres in a square, but if the terrain didn't allow it, you would make certain adjustments. Then after the town was founded, they would set up certain common areas. The plaza, which we all associate with Spanish towns, was very important as a center for activities, for even walking around in the evening. The church would be facing the plaza. Then you would have the town lots surrounding the plaza, and then the agricultural fields lying beyond. But there would be common pastures and an area they called the ejidos, which was a common area which sometimes they term just for recreation. I feel that the people today who feel that the environmentalists finally figured out something new should go back to the old Spanish laws when this was just an open space surrounding the town. The most you could do with it is tie up a cow or a goat, but it was for picnics, for whatever, and it still exists in many of the Spanish towns that you see this ejido or common, just a common park area. Then you also sometimes had a common woods that you would be able to get lumber from, timber to build your houses. But I think probably the most important area was the river or the water supply, which again was in common for the people living in the town.
But as Dr. Engstrand explains, San Diego did not achieve official pueblo or town status until 1835. Before that, we were a military settlement or presidio.
San Diego grew up actually as a presidio. The presidio was located, or you might expect, on Presidio Hill. And then there was the mission quite a few miles inland, I guess 6-7 miles inland. But the Spanish idea was that around a presidio that a pueblo would sort of grow up. The soldiers would marry, they'd have their families. And this is how San Diego sort of started, although late, in the first person or soldier from the presidio to really have a private dwelling was Francisco Ruiz, but this was about 1820, and this was sort of the beginnings of Old Town. So Old Town really grew out of the presidio, and this became the nucleus of what we call the pueblo of San Diego.
One of the factors responsible for the delay in finally achieving pueblo status in San Diego was the extremely small population, a state of affairs not uncommon throughout Alta California.
Well, it started out very slow. The first two pueblos, the first pueblo, San Jose, when it was founded in 1777, had a tough time getting 9 families together to start the town. Los Angeles in 1781 had a tough time getting 11 families to settle. And so then a third pueblo failed completely in near Santa Cruz, Villa de Brancefort, because they never could get hardly enough settlers. And that was the main problem. They advertised free transportation, free food, you know, plots of land, just come to California, you know, we'll take care of you. And still people didn't seem to feel that was going to be the answer to their problems. It was just so far from the centers of civilization that people are familiar with. And although we know California today as being a lovely spot, I think, as I tell my students, if you were in, you know, rather dire circumstances here and someone offered you a beautiful plot of land in Tasmania, I mean, would you just quickly pack your bags and go? I think the people had the same feelings. It's just the unknown and a long trip, an overland trek for, you know, an uncertain goal.
I'm curious if there was a relationship between secularization, which occurred in 1833, secularization of the missions, and the achievement of pueblo status, which came a year or two after that. Was there any relationship between that other than the fact they occurred at about the same time?
Yes, I think there is a relationship in that When the missions were secularized, and I say missions because it was not only Mission San Diego, but Mission San Luis Rey and Mission San Juan Capistrano were all included within the southern area that was related to the Presidio and later the Pueblo of San Diego. When the lands were secularized, it meant that that people could live outside of the Presidio garrison. They had already begun to build a few houses down below the Presidio in what we now call Old Town. Captain Ruiz was probably the first one to build a house around 1820. The soldiers were getting married. They were having families. There wasn't enough room in the Presidio for them. They wanted to have their own homes and their own ranchos. And so then it became necessary, really, to have a civil government for the people who were no longer living in the Presidio, but rather were building their houses around the plaza and living in what was essentially a pueblo. They wanted to have civilian government be able to elect their own alcalde and ayuntamiento, essentially like a mayor and a town council, and have decisions made by themselves rather than by the military authorities, as had been true when San Diego was just a presidio.
If I understand it right, the boundaries of the Pueblo of San Diego were determined by the map drawn by Captain Henry Fitch. And I'd like to ask you how the boundaries were determined. Were, for example, Fitch's boundaries regulated in any way by the Spanish laws, the laws of the Indies?
Well, the general approach to setting up a pueblo, according to the laws of the Indies, or more specifically the recommendations in the plan of Petique, prescribed that a pueblo would be 4 square leagues going outward from a town center, from a plaza. But if the configuration of the land was against that, then they could draw the boundaries in some other fashion. And the Pueblo of San Diego was established in 1835, but the map was not drawn until later. Map was not drawn until 1845, and this is perhaps because there had been no particular need to do so earlier, but with the coming of more Americans, and very clearly there was going to be some sort of a manifest destiny sweeping into California, and there was every reason to believe on the part of many that it would be taken over by the United States. I think that gave an impetus to drawing up not only the boundaries of the Pueblo, but also to giving out the large land grants, because it's in the late 1840s, or that is middle 1840s, just before the American conquest, that most of the big land grants were made. So in order to determine the boundaries of the Pueblo then, Henry Fitch, because of his background as a navigator and a chart maker, was familiar with surveying procedures. This was rather complicated to survey. He and Santiago Arguello, who was the prefect of San Diego at that time, and another man, went out and they staked out the boundaries. And in looking over what they did in relationship to the other existing recognized ranchos, it looks as if what they did was to take the as their southern boundary the recognized ranch, Rancho de la Nación, and as the eastern boundary, the mission lands, the lands that were recognized as belonging to the Mission San Diego de Alcala, and as the northern boundary, they apparently took the Peñasquitos Rancho, which had been granted to Francisco Ruiz in 1823. And so then they drew a triangular boundary running roughly along what is now Highway 805. It goes on the north from approximately Del Mar down to National City on the south, and it follows approximately the boundary of approximately along the route of what is now Highway 805. The Fitch map made San Diego very lucky in that it includes 11 leagues instead of the four leagues that was customary. Los Angeles Pueblo, for instance, only has four leagues, four square leagues, although it attempted to claim four leagues square, which would, of course, have been 16 leagues altogether. And it made this claim before the United States Land Commission later on, trying to get more land. But this claim was denied, and it just has, as its original Pueblo lands, only the four square leagues. Same thing is true of San Francisco. So San Diego was really very fortunate in having Henry Fitch draw up this very generous boundary for us.
Yes, the interpretation of the four square leagues was a little bit loose. Although the leagues, as I did some research on it, was not ever really pinned down too well in the laws of the Indies, and in only one law out of some 6,000 did it even mention this amount of territory, and it was really for a pueblo founded by a contractor. And so some of the later pueblos said, well, we weren't, you know, founded by a contractor, and there's nothing that really says that it has to be four square leagues. And they used this because ranchos generally were four square leagues. But under the Mexican law, Mexican period after 1821, ranchos could be as large as 11 square leagues. So San Diego took advantage of the best of both worlds and was able to get the 11 square leagues.
Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego. Claire, as I understand it, the Pueblo lands were lands set aside for the development of the town. I'm curious if their function changed through the years, as, for example, the region changed to United States rule after the Mexican War. What happened to all these Pueblo lands over the very long period in San Diego history?
Well, the Pueblo lands were, you might say, like a dowry in a way. They were lands that could be sold off by the city council or later by the Board of Trustees, because San Diego lost its charter. It had one in 1850, lost it in 1852, and then from 1852 until 1889, it was governed by a three-man Board of Trustees, and one of the few things that the Board of Trustees could do was to sell land, and they did so, and they sold it very, very cheap, 25 cents, 50 cents, a dollar, $2 an acre. When Alonzo Horton came, for example, he bought 960 acres at what's estimated to be 27 cents an acre, total of what is now virtually all of downtown San Diego, 960 acres for $265 total. They gave 4,000 acres to the Texas and Pacific Railroad, hoping to lure it to build into San Diego. By 1889, of the original nearly 50,000 acres, the city trustees had sold or given away all but about 8,000 acres. And so when San Diego received a new charter, it was decided that it should be amended almost immediately in 1890, amended to prevent further sale of Pueblo lands without a vote of the people. And so we still have that restriction on Pueblo lands, that is, lands which lie within that original Pueblo boundary. In 1929, the man who was then Deputy City Attorney of San Diego, Harry Hopkins, was very, very critical of that early Board of Trustees. He said in his book on the history of San Diego and its Pueblo lands, "Never in all history did city officials start with so much with which to build a city for the benefit of its inhabitants. 50,000 acres of the world's choicest lands were placed in their trust." Then he goes on to say, "To these city officials was delivered America's finest site for a city on a beautiful landlocked harbor. In no other place can men live more pleasantly. Vast outside wealth has been added to these natural wonders. And with what results have these officials administered this sacred trust? No city officials ever received more with which to work, and no trustees ever accomplished so little." In other words, Hopkins considered that they sold it off much too cheap, and that they didn't hang on to more of it as a sort of investment for the future, Nowadays, when we're trying to buy open space land, we have to go out, our city officials now have to go out and buy up canyons, some of which had been originally Pueblo lands, and, you know, pay $1 million or more for the land.
When the Americans came, their use of the Pueblo lands reflected an outlook toward land use different from that of the Spanish. San Diego City Attorney John Witt explains just what these differences were. His comments are followed by those of Assistant City Attorney Robert Tees.
Our thought was that all land would either be held by government or by individuals, and that there would be no joint use of property as there was permitted in the Pueblo lands. So when we came in to the picture and California became part of the United States, they immediately started selling off the Pueblo lands rather quickly, I think. I think you have to look at it in the context of the times. The Pueblo land theory of the Mexicans was just not understood by the Anglo-Saxon settlers. Land is held was held in the rest of the United States by individuals, and not in some sort of community ownership. So it was quite natural, I think, for the town trustees or whatever they were called to do this and to sell it off fairly cheaply with the hopes that it would be developed and therefore contribute to the economy of the community.
Yeah, I must agree with John that the principal reason, at least in my looking at the subject, is that San Diego wanted to entice developers. And one way to entice them was to sell the land off at fairly inexpensive prices. And as you pointed out, one of the early developers, Alonzo Horton, did establish this downtown area, and through his efforts, San Diego is probably what it is today. So I don't think it's all bad.
Assistant City Attorney Robert Tees, preceded by San Diego City Attorney John Witt.